listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tim Wendel, a Washington, D.C.-based author. Well, formerly Washington, D.C. I understand he just moved to Virginia. One of his previous 12 books was a New York Times Review of Books Editor's Choice, and his new book, Cancer Crossings, focuses on the cancer moonshot and how more money is not necessarily the answer to finding the cure for cancer. It's focused, dedicated individuals with creative scientific license. Cancer Crossings is Tim's personal memoir, the story of his family and how they were affected by leukemia. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Tim.
Great to be with you, Monica.
Now, tell us a little bit about the types of books you've written before and how this book maybe is a little different.
Yeah, the previous books, well, this one is a departure, at least in a way. Previous books, I've done a fair amount of sports books. Did a book on 1980 Olympic hockey team going for the gold. Did one called Summer of 68, which was about the 1968, mostly baseball season, but some football, some Olympics, and how in that tumultuous time, sports really kind of held us together as a country as things were flying apart. I've also done a couple novels, probably the best known one being Castro's Curveball, which is off by kind of take what if Fidel Castro had pursued baseball a little bit more than revolution, and which I had never thought about until I made my first trip to Cuba in 1992, and I've made three more since then. That book's been optioned a couple times, never green-lighted out in Hollywood, but that's been fun. But you're right, Cancer Crossings was a little different, and I didn't realize I was getting into the tall grass I was in well over my head, I guess. And in doing so, I never really planned to write a memoir, a family memoir, in my career. I felt I had enough other things who were beating me up pretty good. But this one became a memoir, and you know, and also detailed a lot of the doctors that were involved too.
Well, your brother's leukemia must have had an impact on you. You were the oldest of how many children?
Oldest of six.
Oldest of six.
And yeah, and. But I think it's like, well, I think all of us have, you know, these things in our past or, you know, things we've kind of put off to one side, I guess, a little bit. And I never, you know, certainly I remember my brother, I miss my brother, but that was, you know, that was decades ago. And it wasn't until my daughter, who was then in medical school at Georgetown, she's now a doctor in North Carolina, emergency room doctor. She came home her first year. She would come home periodically. We're living in Northern Virginia then. And, you know, she'd come home, do her laundry, want something to eat, you know, take my car, whatever. And, and the first couple of years, I don't know if anybody, you know, knows folks that have gone through medical school, but the first year, especially and a little bit into the second year, you study everything, every illness known to man, almost everything that can kill you. And half the time the students are studying so hard that they think they're coming down with half of these ailments too. But Sarah came home roughly about this time and they were studying leukemia. And she said, Dad, you had a brother who died of leukemia? And I told her a little bit about this, you know, previously. And I said, yes. And then she started peppering me, Monica, with questions I could not answer. I mean, you know, what was the approach? What were the doctors? What were the meds? You know, how much chemotherapy? What kind of combination, et cetera, et cetera. I was embarrassed. I really couldn't answer them. And she left that night and I went online, you know, and it's amazing what you can find online now. And I still teach at Johns Hopkins, so I can kind of get in, you know, back way into their library system, and Google Scholar is pretty amazing too. And one, you know, I just was trying to answer my daughter's questions initially a little bit. And the first thing that jumped out at me, and I'm not a numbers guy. And in fact, I'm very, in high school, I was terrible at math, but this one set of numbers.
I thought all baseball fans were numbers people.
No, some of it's just kind of, you know, we're more enthralled with the characters of the game, I guess, a little bit. But the first set of numbers that absolutely floored me was when my brother Eric was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is kind of the biggest form or was of childhood leukemia, 10% survival rate. You know, we're talking mid-60s. And that's a death sentence. I mean, you're lucky if you're going to pull out of that. Today, the survival rate is better than 90%. And this is what my daughter was, you know, she was, this is where she was coming at it from, in a sense, how did he die? You know, it's now 90, 95%. And so I, you know, I think with any project you're looking for, well, we start here and we go here. And numbers, again, I usually don't start with, but I did in this case. I started, wow, not that long ago, less than a half century ago, we were at 10% survival rate. Now we're better than 90%. You know, you mentioned in the lead-in about a cancer moonshot. We had one. You know, you take something from 10% to 90%, that's an amazing success story. And then the other thing that happened that night, and I stayed up pretty late, is I started looking through a couple of the reports, the clinical trials, and to be honest, at that point in time, I could not understand much of them at all. But I started seeing the same names, James Holland, Donald Pinkel, Lucius Sinks, Avery Freeman, and they kept showing up time and time again. And then, and especially Lucius's Sinks name, I remember my mother at one point saying, okay, he's director of pediatrics at Roswell Park in Buffalo, where my brother was. And at that point, I went, whoa, these are the guys who did it. You know, this is this small, select, resilient group that turned the tide against childhood leukemia. And then the next question you start asking yourself is, are they still around? Can I find them? Mm. And I
was
did.
It hard, you know, to track them down?
Some were more difficult than others, but, you know, because they were, most of them were no longer in Buffalo. They had pretty much gone, actually, around the world. One guy was working in Tel Aviv and in Israel. But the first, say, Pinkel, who actually went on to start up St. Jude Hospital in Memphis, that you see all the ads with Marlo Thomas mm-hmm. and all that. You know, he was relatively easy to find. James Holland, who unfortunately just passed on, he was working at Mount Sinai. The one, though, and we're back now to Lucius Sinks, and I always love that name, I couldn't find him. You know, and I kept asking, in a sense, you know, the fellow doctors he was with at Buffalo, what happened to Lucius? Where'd Lucius go? And some people felt, oh, he went to Europe. Others felt he was up in New England. And ironically, it took me several months to find him, but he was in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I now make my home. And for all of a week now. And but one, you know, that's only about 2 hours from DC, from my house in DC. And I started coming down, and we would have lunch about every other month. And I knew I needed him for the book, Monica, because he's, you know, he's the top pediatric guy at Roswell Park. But then we became pretty good friends. And I think we've, over the years of doing the book, enjoyed each other's company, and I guess in a roundabout way, that's what kind of led me down to Charlottesville.
I wondered, you know, after spending so much time there, it became someplace you considered moving.
Yeah, and it was, you know, that wasn't the only factor. I mean, we had a big house. My kids have launched. You know, I've got a doctor daughter, and my son is. He works for Instagram out on the West Coast. So they weren't coming back. So it was, you know, time to get out of the house, so to speak. But, yeah, I think part of it was coming down here, seeing the mountains and just feeling like, well, I know it a little bit, you know, simply, you know, having.
Right. And you're still close enough to D.C. You're still close enough to D.C. to be in the action if you need to be or want to be.
Yeah, when I feel like driving in traffic, I'll go back. And certainly when I want to teach and such. It's funny, a friend of mine, you know, when these, you know, these trips down to Charlottesville became a regular thing, and they kind of become one of the threads in the
book. I mean, there's several scenes where we always met at the same place. We always had the same table at the same restaurant. And a friend of mine was, you know, once he heard about this, another author teased me a little bit. He said, "Oh my, look what you're up to. You know, Mitch Albom had Tuesdays with Maury. You're having lunches with Lucius." And I'm going, yeah. And so away we went.
So from that beginning, what was it that made you want to really dig more deeply into this topic?
It started with trying to answer my daughter's questions, but then I was very curious at times what my brother had gone through, because we never had like a big sit down, leave it to Beaver meeting around the kitchen table and say, so-and-so's got this terrible disease and this is what it means. You know, a lot was left unspoken. And so there was that curiosity. You know, this was part of my life, but I really wasn't quite sure what was going on. But I'll tell you too, Monica, the other thing that floored me early on, especially after I talked to Dr. Holland and Dr. Pinkel, and they both brought it up in almost a roundabout way, but at this point in time, we're talking like the mid to late 60s, if you looked at, say, the handbook, the pediatric handbook under the heading leukemia, you would find one or two pages, and it pretty much said, make the patient as comfortable as possible. He or she is going to leave us soon, in a sense, pass on.
Wow.
And these guys refused to accept it. They said, no, something else has to be done. There must be something we can do. And frankly, early on, you know, for their determination, they were singled out. They were ostracized by the medical community. They were called killers, poison pushers, misfits, cowboys, because they were daring to go outside the parameters of what was considered, you know, kind of accepted medical practice at that point. And I think in some ways that's the mindset, the resiliency that we could use a little bit more of today. I mean, they were so determined and unwilling to take kind of no for an answer when it came to what could be done with this very often cruel disease.
So where you lived, Buffalo, had this hospital, Roswell, that was at the forefront of this research.
Yeah, and it was one of these serendipity moments, because, you know, if it hadn't been, there were other quality hospitals, Boston, New York, my brother would have been taken there, and we would have seen a lot less of him, and we wouldn't have been able to do as much, say, you know, obviously as a family with the sailing and the hockey and all the things we did together. Roswell Park was a little over a half hour from my hometown in Lockport, New York, and they were one of the places, and they were one of the few excellent places at that point. You can probably, when my brother was diagnosed, again, mid-late 60s, count on one hand the institutions, the hospitals that were stepping up into the forefront of this. And it was Roswell Park, probably Dana-Farber in Boston, MD Anderson, Houston, probably Mount Sinai, New York. And that was roughly about it.
Did all of those have the pediatric studies and trials that you had at Roswell Park?
No, not as much. And it was mostly because James Holland, they had the first initial national group on this was called ALGB. It was called Acute Leukemia Group B. And that was just kind of the name. And that was the name they made up for it out of the National Cancer Institute out of Washington. And again, it was serendipity. James Holland, who is like one of the pioneers in all this and just, you know, passed on a couple of days ago, unfortunately, at the age of 91, was still working at Mount Sinai until he died, looking for a cure for women's breast cancer. He had been at NCI, National Cancer Institute, outside of D.C., and then had taken the top job in Buffalo at Roswell Park. And he was thought so highly within the medical community, especially the doctors that were fighting against cancer, the campaign against cancer, that they did something very unusual. Like, you know, even though he was moving, what, 350, 400 miles away, they pretty much said, can you still, in a sense, be our leader? Can you still be the head of this group? And he said, yes. And so that was the type of expertise that was in, you know, a medium-sized city like Buffalo at that point in time.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. Do you think that your brother lived longer as a result of that?
No, for sure. Yeah. I think when he, the original diagnosis was, and this was true for all kids with ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, was it was roughly about 12 months, you know, maybe 18. He lived for 8, and ironically, you know, didn't technically die of ALL. He passed because of a chickenpox. He contracted chickenpox, and his immune system was so ravaged, and this was, what, several decades before we had a vaccine for chickenpox. You know, that's what did him in. But, you know, you look back, and obviously you want, you know, anybody does, they want more time with loved ones and that type of thing. But, you know, if I'm weighing two things, I got a year or I've got 8 years, yeah, I'll take 8 years, and we'll just cram as much living as we could into it, and we pretty much did as a family.
And it sounded like your brother was very had a very positive attitude, because a lot of his treatments must have been uncomfortable, even painful, not to mention the symptoms of the disease.
Yeah, but he was I don't know, he was at some points people would look at our family, again, a family of six, and we were rambunctious and we were all over the place, and they were kind of, he didn't quite fit in some ways. His hair color was a little bit different. It was, you know, most of us had black hair, now gray, but black hair then. And his was more reddish. And he was, in a way, more thoughtful, a little bit more reserved in a way. But, boy, he was wicked smart. And one of the stories that I put in Cancer Crossings that I think underscores what kind of kid he was, is they were up at Roswell Park. He was getting some treatment, and you're right, you know, a lot of it was, you know, painful. You know, I can't quite imagine going through it myself. But they often had puzzles, like on various tables, especially in the children's ward. And, you know, anybody was there, you know, killing some time. Okay, you know, put a couple more pieces in the puzzle. And Eric was working on one of those one day, and one of the doctors came by. It wasn't Lucius Sinks, it was one of the younger ones, and was talking to my mother about, you know, the latest round of, meds or what was going to happen next. And Eric was pretty much just working on the puzzle, but he's still kind of half listening. And at one point, the doctor, after finishing talking with my mom, just kind of, you know, starts talking to Eric a little bit. How you doing today? How you feeling? Whatever. And out of the blue, you know, and the doctor goes, I see you're working on a puzzle. And Eric says, yeah, I'm working on a puzzle. I like puzzles. I hope you're good at them too. And what was left unspoken was everything they were doing then was a puzzle. And it was, how fast could you put the pieces together? Because that was going to keep more people alive.
This was the doctors who really came up with the idea of drug cocktails for chemotherapy.
Very much. I mean, until this point, and again, there's a lot of things we take for granted now. Chemotherapy drugs, I mean, you hear that all the time. But these were the first doctors to kind of, in a sense, you know, they were chemotherapy drugs, but they were pretty much being used one at a time, maybe two at a time. If you look at my brother's medical records, it's sometimes 5 or 6 chemotherapy drugs at a time. And that's what they were doing. They were accelerating things. And again, we're back to the puzzle a little bit. They weren't quite sure at times, is 6-MP going to work with diamessine, going to work with methotrexate? Let's give it a shot. Because the alternative was the patient's just going to go downhill in a hurry. And it's funny, you know, again, things we take for granted now, almost accepted, that you could have 4, 5, even 6, 7 different chemotherapy drugs and different regimens and dosages and everything. That's what these guys discovered when pretty much the rest of the medical community was almost saying, don't you dare.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tim Wendel, author of 13 books, most recently Cancer Crossings, A Brother, His Doctors, and The Quest to Cure Childhood Leukemia. It was interesting to me that for these various trials, sometimes the doctors had trouble finding enough patients because the local family doctors weren't cooperating very well.
Yeah, there was a real fear of the unknown, I guess, at that point in time. And it was difficult because, again, we're back to what the pages in the pediatric handbook said. Why bother? You know, why even try to, you know, fight this disease? It doesn't matter anyway. And these guys, men, doctors and nurses, and I want to underscore the nurses were so empowered with at these hospitals, you know, dared to do something else. And I still remember back when my brother was first starting to get diagnosed. It wasn't officially diagnosed. He had ALL yet, but we, you know, there was a sense something was wrong and something was pretty wrong. He had a bruise on his shin that wasn't going away. He was lethargic, which was unusual for him, you know, even at the age of 3. I mean, he was a very outgoing kid. And before, this was like the night or two before he ended up being admitted in the Roswell Park up in Buffalo. He ended up at our local hospital in Lockport. And frankly, Monica, the personnel, medical personnel there did not know what to make of him. They pretty much just said, stay in your bed, and they closed the door, and there was even concerns he could be contagious, you know, with leukemia. And my mother had a cleaning lady at the time who came in every now and then, and as soon as she caught wind of that, she quit. And if you think about it, a generation ago, and we're still kind of antsy about it these days, but even the word cancer wasn't even said that much. It was called the C word and such. How even speaking it could kind of bring this almost like evil spirit into your house. And again, this was the backdrop that these doctors were moving against.
Wow. So, Tim, you mentioned that you're a professor at Johns Hopkins University and you're now a writer in residence. What exactly does that entail?
Actually, it's pretty easy. I've had that.
It's a tough job, but somebody has to do it.
It's a tough job, but some lazy bones like me can do it. And it's funny because I guess I've been that now 4 or 5 years, something like that. And when they offered me that title at Hopkins, and you know, and I still go back obviously periodically, because I'm a couple hours away now. I said, what do I have to do for this? And I remember the program director said, well, you got to write. And I'm going, well, I can do that. And you have to reside. And I went, well, I guess whatever I am, I'm residing. And I said, yeah, I can do that. So, but it's funny now with the way everything's – I'm right now teaching a class at Hopkins that's online. We're mostly online. We meet sometimes in the classroom. But because we're online, it's opened up – all these things. I've got a student in Hong Kong. I've got several in Denver. And it's interesting what's going on in education right now.
And you're teaching writing?
Yeah, I teach writing. And I teach both fiction and nonfiction. I'm teaching that online class as a science medical class, writing, science medical writing class right now. And here's the dirty little secret, Monica. I kind of teach them all the same. Meaning you know, it's all, you know, where is the story set? Is a provocative place? You know, what are the characters? Are the characters ones I want to follow? Are the scenes good? And my shorthand, and my students get sick of it after a while, but my shorthand for quality scene is action, usually by one of the characters, leads to an event that leads to some degree of consequence. I mean, there's your shorthand for quality scene, and you can see it in movies or in books, and, you know, the scenes that stay with us are usually done pretty well with that action to event to consequence line.
Now, it's interesting to me that you're teaching medical science writing. Before this book, had you done medical science writing?
Not that much. I'd done a fair amount of nonfiction and creative nonfiction writing. And I had some science students in there, or ones who were doing more science, say features or even essays. But yeah, I guess this book, they got me in the door to doing that too. But again, don't tell my bosses.
One thing I found really, really interesting about this book is that you do learn a lot about medicine and about the science behind the medicine, but it's, you learn it just sort of along with the story. So it makes it much easier, much more palatable than reading a bunch of dry facts about chemotherapy drugs. And I think that that's the way we learn best, is through story and associating things with story.
I think you're absolutely right. And it heartens me that you said that, because that was kind of my goal. Number one, I don't know enough medical stuff anyway that I'm going to roll out, you know, a whole thing of chemotherapy drugs and all this. But if I could personify it or link up quality characters to it, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's when, you know, what we learn. That's when the power of story is just can be so provocative and alluring. It's funny. I'll go in usually in the spring, because one of the things Hopkins has a number of, you know, programs. I mean, they're like any school these days. But one of them is they've got a museum studies, in a sense, major curriculum, whatever. And I'll go in and speak to them, even though I don't really teach classes in museum studies. I mean, I have done a little bit of museum work with the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown with baseball and that type of thing, but that's really, really off in the periphery. What I'll do, though, is they have me in, and we do about 2 hours, and it's about storytelling. And I kind of warn them up front. I go, this is going to be a blur, because I'm going to take what I think is maybe the best stuff, and we're going to spend the whole semester together, and we're going to jam it into 2 hours and just go. And we look at everything from, you know, what's on the page. We look at things from movies. We look at music, you know, the structure in music, because I think if you can, you know, a pop song, if you can, you know, understand the structure in a pop song, that makes it sometimes easier now to understand the structure, say, in a nonfiction profile or story. And some of them, I know their heads are spinning, but we have a lot of fun. So, I bring that up because it all kind of pertains back to the power of a story. If we can put it in a story, it makes it much more palpable, it makes it more entertaining. And I think you're absolutely right. I can ask you about that a couple weeks from now, and if I put it out in the form of a story, you're much more prone to remember it.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think that's just the way our brains are wired to work.
I think you're right. If you look at, now we're going way off on a tangent, but if you look at some of the work Carl Jung did, certainly Joseph Campbell with Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is a book I try to read about every 3 years, and they kind of make the claim that we are born somehow with some basic wiring to understand story. And that's why if you're a writer and you're looking to do this as a living, certainly you want original stuff and you want, have new things. But sometimes when I'm really stuck in terms of, oh, that's not working, what's wrong here? I, in a sense, go back to, okay, what are the basic parts of story? And I studied under some great people, but one of them was Alan Shoes for a while over at George Mason University. And Alan was of the mind, there's only two types of story. Now, I'd argue with him about this, and I wasn't alone, but he felt all stories break down to kind of two basic motifs or templates. Either it's a journey story, let's go in search of leukemia doctors and see if we can find them and go around the country, or his other one was a stranger comes to town and everything changes. And he felt those were the two basic stories. And so sometimes, you know, I think especially when you get writing, you end up way off in the briar patch somewhere And so sometimes it's good to remind yourself, going, okay, what are the basic components of story that almost the reader isn't expecting? Not that you're going to bore them with it, but they're kind of looking for these a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, I find one of the things I've always found interesting, you know, they say there's a certain limited number of plots. Now, I've never heard it boiled down to two.
Yeah, Alan took it to a real extreme. But,
but you know, there have been lists of, you know, everything's 15 or 10 or something. Mm-hmm. But I've always found it fascinating that the Shakespeare plays not only almost always have one of two plots, one of which either involves cross-dressing characters.
Yes.
Or if you don't have the cross-dressing characters, you've got I can't remember what the other one is, but you also almost always have a duke, and you almost always have some kind of storm or natural event that upsets everything. And of course, you know, oh, and you always have a conflict between the a boy and a girl.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing I love Shakespeare too. And one of the things I love about it too is I'll talk to my students sometimes about character. And I think it was Ian Forrester said there's, you can put character, you know, your characters in the two different categories. Round, meaning they have some depth. They're probably going to change. They better change in some way. They have some resonance, whatever. Like in Romeo and Juliet are round characters.
Okay.
But you also have flat characters. And flat characters don't change that much. But the great thing about, say, Shakespeare is his flat characters are great. He gives them great lines. He gives them funny scenes. I mean, you think, and I'm back to Romeo and Juliet again, but the nurse, right, you know, Juliet's nurse in that play is a flat character, but she's great. And Mercutio is, you know, Romeo's buddy before he gets sliced up or whatever, gives this beautiful soliloquy about love. And that's one of the things I always loved about Shakespeare. It's like, you know, those are flat characters. They aren't going to resonate with you like the main players are. If you stop that play halfway through and just said, okay, whoever hasn't seen this, you know, who are the main players? And they went, well, it's that guy Romeo and that girl Juliet. Yeah, okay. And yeah, because they're the round characters. But Shakespeare's so magnanimous with his lines and giving good scenes to flat characters that I think it gives it incredible depth at work.
And another interesting thing is that even no matter how tragic a story is, there's almost always comic relief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He lets you up for air.
Yeah.
And if you look at, it's funny, back to the, one of the things I do with the museum studies folks, we do that St. Crispin's speech in Henry V, and, you know, us band of brothers, and there's so many great lines out of there that you just realize, you want to fly away home, and Douglas MacArthur used that in his farewell speech and all this. But in what's amazing about that is I'll roll it. I usually use the kind of Verona one, you know, the more recent one. And I'll just say, okay, you know, there's points here where Shakespeare is going to let you up for air, number one, so you understand what's going on, and also to build, in a sense, the tension. There's three major, maybe more, pauses in the midst of that St. Crispin speech, and that we're just before the Battle of Agincourt. And I always make the joke after we watch it, we count the pauses. One is the French guy riding in to say what's going to be the ransom, and Henry V turns down ransom, you know, just, you know, sell my bones or whatever. And we'll get to the end of that. And it's only 5 minutes. People can look at this online. It's beautiful. It's just great. But I always make the joke, if the French had attacked, you know, during one of these pauses, history would have been different, you know, because, but you need those kind of coming up to a big scene, because I think if you pause just a little bit, I mean, you don't have to be going really fast anymore, because if you don't have the reader at that point, you're not going to have them. But if you pause a little bit, it's almost this little nod or acknowledgement that, ooh, something big's coming. Pay attention. Mm. And you see this a lot in movies and in books too. Before the big scene, things get still. Things slow down. You know, we don't run headlong into a big scene because that's the little telltale sign that this is big. So it's fun to have fun with that.
I never really thought about that. I'm going to have to watch for that now.
Watch it. You know, email me. I'll give you at least a couple of the pauses.
All right.
And actually, in that scene, too, you'll see a very young Christian Bale. Years and years before he plays Batman or anything.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tim Wendell, author of Cancer Crossings, A Brother, His Doctors, and the Quest to Cure Childhood Leukemia. Tim is also the Walter E. Dakin Fellow and Tennessee Williams Scholar to the Sewanee Writing Conference. Tell me a little bit about writing conferences, and, you know, I'm guessing that you recommend them for people who are wanting to become writers. What can you get from a writing conference?
I think I wouldn't recommend them, say, carte blanche, but I think that there's certain times that I tend to go to writing conferences for one or two or three different reasons. Number one, if I'm really stuck with something and I need some input, they can be a great place to kind of hot wire a piece that's stalled out. For example, I did, it became a novella. It was a novel once, called Habana Libre. And one of the years I was down at Sewanee with it, and I had so many characters. It was all over the place. It was a mess. And I got together with Alice McDermott, who's also at Hopkins, but I was helping out in her workshop, and she read part of it. And she just, and we sat down, and she said, "You got a lot going on here." I'm going, "Yeah, maybe too much." She's going, "Yeah, I think so too." And then she told me something I'll never forget. She said, "Why don't you find, you know, it's up to you. You're the writer. But focus in on the, you know, the couple characters, a handful of characters you're really enthralled with," and then I'll never forget this quote. She said, "And follow the fun with them." And that book kind of shrunk, but it became, I think, a much better read. So that's one. You know, you're stalled out and just stymied on something, a workshop can be, a summer conference workshop can be very good. Another reason I'll go is if there's some, say, particular writers that I'm enthralled by, and maybe this is my chance to study with them, or at least hear them or hang with them. And for many years, when I was first starting, I did the Squaw Valley Writers Workshop out in California, and that's where I met Richard Ford, Amy Tan, Oakley Hall. And sometimes my students will go, "Boy, you've been really lucky. You've studied with some great teachers." And I go, "Yeah, I've been lucky, but I've also kind of put myself right in their path, kind of going, here I am." And I think the last one is writing's a very solitary, can be lonely pursuit. And the last year that I went to Sewanee, I needed some more and maybe better readers of my material. And I went down and I fell in with this amazing group. It was Alice's workshop. But a guy named Greg Downs has become a dear friend who kind of can do a great first read to some stuff of mine. A guy named Brendan Matthews has got a new novel out. Holly Goddard Jones. We're all in the same workshop. And I had gone, you know, I kind of knew what I was doing roughly a little bit with Habana Libre, but I was desperate to find some more compadres, some more writing friends. And that's why I went the last time. Mm. So, and I think that's where it can be really beneficial, because in this day and age, between obviously email and Skype and all this stuff, you can stay in touch with folks.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I'm fortunate here living close to Iowa City. Mm-hmm. I've attended the U of I Summer Writing Conference a number of years, and it's always fun and meet really interesting people. There's some great writers that teach there. Now, it's geared, the workshop participants are mostly, I would say, unpublished writers. It sounds like the Sewanee conference, maybe you have a lot of published writers attending that.
Maybe, but I think we're all at, we're all at some crossroads. We're all trying to figure something out. And I don't know about you, I can only figure out so much alone in my room. I'll throw darts at a wall. At some point I have to go out and go, I don't know, what do you think of this? And some of the insights people have just right off the bat I find amazing. And I don't know about you, but when I go to those, I just feel reinvigorated. I feel recharged.
I do too, and unfortunately it doesn't last long enough for me to actually get any progress done when I get home. But that's because I've got several businesses and I've got a pretty full schedule. And although it's not an excuse, there is always time to write if you really want to. Do you?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because, I don't know. I can remember, especially so much of this is kind of pushing the rock up the hill, and then it starts going down the hill and you're running to catch up. But like, say, Castro's Curveball, I mean, that came out, good guy. That's like 17 years ago now or something when that first came out with Random House. But at that point in my time, I didn't have very much time. You know, we always fill up our time. And the only time I had then, my kids were much younger. I had a high-powered job. I had 20 minutes roughly each way on the metro in D.C. between my stop and work, and, you know, between home and work. And I started writing, you know, I decided I've got to be writing every day. I've got to try this at least a bit. And I was working on Curveball, and I was only trying to write a page in a spiral notebook. That's the only thing I said. And I still remember getting metro one morning, Monica, and it was already a bad day. It was already one of those. It's like 8:30 in the morning. It's already a lousy day. And I didn't write. I mean, the subway took off and I was still sitting there, and I got halfway to my stop, you know, to work. And I just said, hang on a minute. You said you were going to do this. And I got out the notebook and I just started writing some things very quickly. And I was writing in a first person voice that I like to think is more naive and desperate than my own. And I was just writing very quickly. And I was like, whoops, here's my stop. Time to go to work. And I closed the notebook, went off to work. It wasn't until I got home that night and opened up the notebook, and I was like reading this, and I was going, whoa, I like this voice. This voice is kind of interesting. And Curveball initially was all written in third person. I rewrote Curveball all in that first person voice, kind of a washed up American catcher in Cuba, a guy named Billy Bryan. And it was a pain to rewrite it all in first person. I think that voice, it's definitely the voice sold the book. The voice is the reason that book's had, you know, a measure of success. I remember being, I think it was at NYU in New York, doing a reading from it. And somebody stood up, a woman in the back, and she'd already read the book. And she said something effect of, I don't care much about Cuba. I sure hate baseball. Fidel Castro, who cares? But that voice, I'd follow anywhere. And I went, thank God I picked up my pen that day. So
now, it's interesting. Could you have still done the voice in third person? Did it have to be first person?
I'm not so – I bet you I could. Maybe I could now. Back then, I don't think I had the chops. And I think one of the things – see, first person can be very effective, I think, and I think maybe the ultimate example is Great Gatsby by Fitzgerald. First person, I think, works beautifully when it's kind of in that sidekick role. You know, think of Gatsby. You know, the person telling you that is Nick Carraway. And the fact, if you look at the first couple pages of that, if it kept going that way, you go, ah, this stinks. And you just go, I'm out of here. But you can, what I call fade the voice, that first person voice in and out, and you can get us really close to somebody provocative, somebody in power, et cetera. And you see it in Gatsby. There's times you start going, man, this guy
Gatsby's a schmo. You know, I don't think much of this guy. But then that voice of Nick's kind of almost right in your ear going, hang on, you know, hang loose. You know, he'll prove himself to you yet. And then there's other times where that voice just, that first voice just totally drops away almost. And it just rolls out in these major scenes. Like, you know, the first scene with Daisy and Tom and Jordan where Nick's gone over to visit them. That rolls out almost as a third person scene. So that worked for me in Curveball because, you know, I've got this larger-than-life character. I've got a young Fidel Castro at roughly age 21 or 22, as dynamic and charismatic as he became politically. And it's Billy Bryan who gets us close to him, you know, and tries to interpret some of it. Some of it maybe erroneously, but he'll interpret it. And it's almost like, you know, you're sitting at the bar and somebody's telling a great story. Now, if that story keeps going on for 3 hours, it's not that great of stories. But, that first kind of whiff of it, that's I think where first person can work really well.
Yeah, you're right about, you know, when we were talking about story that goes on too long can lose somebody, although I'm in the middle of a pretty long book right now that I'm just loving.
Oh, what's that?
A Gentleman in Moscow.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of this. I've not read this, but I'm just check it out.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm listening to it on Audible, and I'm just, like, wanting to listen to it all the time.
All right, I'm writing that down. My next trip into D.C., I'll listen to that.
Now, I'm guessing Habana Libre is set in Cuba.
Yes.
So what attracts you, what draws you to Cuba?
I made my first trip in early in 1992. I've made three other trips since. In fact, as recently as last January. It is, it's such a star-crossed land to me. It's beautiful. I'd recommend people take a look at the photographs in the New York Times travel piece, I don't know, from a week or so ago. It's a beautiful city. Havana is, in the shadows, in the half light, you know, at dusk, at dawn. The people are extraordinary. And all this is what blows my mind is all this is going on, 90 miles away from us.
Yeah.
And it's very much, I've called it the land time forgot. And yet there it is. It's not like it's the other side of the world. It's right there. And it's amazing.
So when they opened up travel to Cuba, it went on the top of my list of places to go, but are they backing off from letting Americans go there now?
You just email me. Yeah, it'll be fine. No, it's not, you know, they're still, it's not that difficult. And the people have so many great stories. I mean, we stayed at a place this last time, a woman, you know, she had the whole floor, 11th floor of a 14-story building in West Havana. And I should have put this together earlier, but I didn't. She's 80 years old, and she made us breakfast every morning and would kind of tell us stories and this type of thing. And we're talking with her one of the mornings over breakfast, and her English wasn't that great. My Spanish goes up and down. And but the gist of it was she grew up on the eastern end of the island and had come to Havana, say, at the age of, I don't know, 19, 20, something like that. And over one of these breakfasts, my wife asked, well, what brought you to Havana? How did you come to Havana if you grew up like hours away, like 8, 9 hours away in the eastern part of the country? And she just looked at us like we were crazy. And she said, I came with Fidel. And we went, huh? And wow. And she was in the army. And at first she, you know, we were a little skeptical, and she starts pulling out her medals from the Battle of Santa Clara and some siege and all this stuff. And then I put it together. It clicked. I said, you got this entire floor because you were a good revolutionary. You know, you were in the army. And she said, of course.
Oh, so, wow.
So those are the type of people you bump into all over the place, and it's just mind-boggling.
So, Tim, you probably are familiar with the Cuba Libre alcoholic beverage.
Yes.
Okay. Rum and Coke. At least yes. if I was correctly informed. Do you know the term Menteria?
Menteria, no.
Menteria. When I was 17, I went to Spain with a college group, and we had a professor who was from Cuba. He was a Cuban exile. And being 17 and in Spain, I didn't know how to order very many beverages, but it was easy to say Rum y Coke or vodka y naranja. So,
sure.
But our professor told us that rum and Coke was Cuba Libre, but you should not call it that. Call it Menteria, which means little lie, because Cuba's not free, and Cuba Libre would mean free Cuba. So.
Next time I'm down there, I'll
and I still remember that many, many, many years later.
Even that, I just go with a mojito, you know, and go from there.
Yeah, so well, that would work too. Tim, did you always want to be a writer?
It's funny. Not always, but certainly when I was back, say 15, 16, 17. And the thing is, again, now we're back to one's past and what we forget about our past. And one of the last, I worked with some great editors with Cancer Crossings. In fact, Gary Brozek, who was my editor on Castro's Curveball, who now is a successful ghostwriter himself, read one of the early drafts and said, okay, I'm on board. I see what you're doing, but you're going to have to answer one question for me. And I went, okay, what's that? And he said, how did this change you or impact you as a parent? And I went, I didn't think of that. That was difficult to tease out. One of the last kind of questions I had like that was the book was due, you know, in a couple weeks, and I'm racing to get it done. I think I did about 6 revisions toward the end because I'm trying to find the pivot points where we could go from family back to the doctors and where things kind of linked up and where even those stories overlapped a little bit, which they did often in terms of place. And I got a call from my editor up in Ithaca, Cornell, Dean, and he said, you know, and I had been by Ithaca like a couple times the month before. And it was so funny because he said, are you coming by again? And I'm going, no, I'm trying to get this book done. And then the next day he calls up and goes, I'd love to see you. And I'm going, Dean, we're not going to see each other in person right now because I got to finish this book. Third day he calls and he says, I guess you're not coming by. And I'm going, no kid, you're like 5-6 hours out of the way. I'm trying to get this done. Are you listening to me? And he said, okay, well, I had one last question I needed to ask you, and I was hoping I could ask you this when we were hiking Buttermilk Falls or something like that. I'm going, oh, no. And I go, what's the question? And my grandfather was a civil engineer. My father was a civil engineer, even though he wanted to be an architect. They started up a very successful engineering firm that right now has offices several places around the East. And, you know, being the oldest of 6, at least for a while, I was supposed to be the next civil engineer. But when I was like 15, 16, I remember announcing at a family dinner, I'm not going to be an engineer, I'm going to be a writer. And you could hear kind of a pin drop for like a minute or two. And now on the phone with Dean, Dean's going, I don't think you make that. He knew about this. He said, I don't think you make that decision and you're not so sure about it. If, you know, you don't go into being a writer, sports writer, whatever, if you didn't have a brother who died young, I think that gave you kind of the chutzpah, the gumption, the determination to do that. You know, and he kind of rolled this out and he just said, am I right or not? And I was like, oh, no, God. And finally, you know, after a couple seconds, I had to say, you're right. He goes, I thought so. I need that like on page 170 or something like that. I need like 3 graphs about that. And it's funny, after he brought that up, I realized, and I think this is what happens when we write, you know, we kind of discover things, we can bring maybe a sliver of order to the chaos that's our lives. And I realized, like, you know, I'm not maybe that good with money, and sometimes, you know, my relationships can be up and down. I should do better by people and such. But the thing, Monica, drives me nuts is wasting time. And I realize that goes back to my brother.
Of course.
You know, time's not infinite. You know, it's like it can slip away real fast. And so it's kind of, you better make the most of it, because when, you know, nothing of it is guaranteed. So, you know, that was one of the major things that I just learned about myself in doing cancer crossings.
Well, just as an aside, my father was also a civil engineer. And he got his engineering degree from Cornell.
Wow. That's bizarre. By the banks of Cayuga Lake. I love it.
Yeah. But I was under no pressure whatsoever to become an engineer.
I wasn't under that much, but but it's funny too. Sometimes, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, things that can be taught and such. I will sometimes look at a story, and I know I'm seeing it almost a little bit like an engineer does. Okay, here's block A, here's block B, and, you know, you're trying to vary it up and everything. So some of it stuck.
Yeah.
You know, the major thing.
And cancer crossings is, you do have a complicated structure in there, because you're, first of all, you're trying to accomplish quite a bit in one book. You're telling the story of your brother, you're telling the story of this cancer moonshot, and you're telling the story of the individual doctors within it. And so you're having to move back and forth somewhat in time, certainly in place, certainly in who you're focusing on in the story. And that definitely requires an orderly mind to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, this orderly mind got somewhat destroyed by doing it, but it was kind of, I think it was, yeah, 2 summers ago when it was revising it. Dean was calling up and saying, come visit me, all this. It's funny, we got to the end of that summer, and I told my wife, I said, hang on. We've got a new barbecue. How come we haven't had anybody over? I mean, usually we're having all these barbecues. And, you know, the summer's about done. We must have hit Labor Day or something. And she just looked at me and just shaking her head going, barbecues? You want a barbecues? I mean, you haven't been away from your desk, you know, in months. I mean, we had no time for barbecues. So, you know, it was another summer for barbecues.
You mentioned that, you know, wasting time is something that really bothers you a lot. Do you find yourself kind of torn between the time, you know, spending time in productive ways and enjoying things like having barbecues? I mean, I do. Like, I want to be the person who entertains and has dinner parties, and I feel like that's what makes life worth living, but instead, I'm also like, you can't waste time. You got to get things done. You got to accomplish things. And that's where my time ends up going.
Yeah. I hopefully I've learned over the years to take the foot off the accelerator a little bit, because I think sometimes the insights and, you know, you talk about the organization of Cancer Crossings, which was a little bit more complicated than I thought it was going to be. A lot of those epiphanies or insights only came when I kind of backed off just a little bit. Because it's amazing, I think, sometimes if you – I'll do this, you know, every now and then when I'm really stuck. I'll be going, okay, I'm here with this project or this story. I'm not quite sure where it should go next or what's the next logical moment. And I'll just kind of – you know, almost kind of envision myself putting it in the back of my mind a little bit, just in a – okay, you know, something will bubble up. And something usually does. You know, I've got to give it some time. I can't, you know.
Well, Tim, yeah. We are out of time. Speaking of time. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
My pleasure, Monica. Great to be with you.